Thank you to the organizers for putting this together. I always think it's really impressive when people step up and organize these conferences that, you know, provide some much needed community, I think. I really appreciate it. And I genuinely want to thank the organizers for that. Yeah, I'm really happy to be here at Perimeter. You know, I've always wanted to visit. It's so great to have this excuse. And I'm happy to tell you all about the ground model for elliptic cohomology. And everything that I tell you that's original, that Stan Burrick happens. So, there you go. Please tell me if you can't hear me or see me or anything like that right off the bat. I know there's a lawnmower outside. I think he's blocked out enough, but you know, just tell me if earlier rather than later. So first of all, what is elliptic cohomology? That's always a good question to ask before trying to answer any question about it. And mostly I'm going to be following ideas of these authors here, Panaski, Mike-Hopkins, Siegel, Stoltz, and Teichner, and Witten. The authors are listed. I didn't make any attempt to give chronological precedence here. I certainly didn't make any attempt to give important precedence. They're just listed alphabetically. I just want to acknowledge right off the authors whose ideas I, you know, significantly followed in developing this, and the story I'm about to tell you. So let's start with the elliptic genus. This is going to overlap somewhat with Davide's talk last night or last morning or whenever it was, so I might go a little quickly, but again, please stop me if you have any questions. So given a two-dimensional quantity, we always have the partition function, which we can take. A priori, maybe you just think of it as the trace over this Hilbert space H of e to the beta H, where H is their Hamiltonian. That probably makes you happy if you're a physicist. If you're more of a mathematician, you're usually like the Lagrangian formalism better. So we'll just think of this as some path integral over fields on a torus of the e to the ix, the action there. And this is some function, the partition function z, that depends on, let's say we're doing this partition function over a torus, that depends on the tau parameter of a torus, and it's not holomorphic, so let's also make explicit the tau bar dependence here. If you don't know and you know are interested, this beta over on the left-hand side gets interpreted tau equals I beta over on the right-hand side, but I'm going to go ahead and think of tau as a general complex number, maybe in the upper half. And this function satisfies the crucial property that if I invert tau and tau bar, I have some kind of equivalence here. Well, okay, I mean, this is an aspirational statement. This is if, for example, it's conformal and conformal.
Are you talking about a quantum field theory or a conformal field theory?
Yeah, so this is an aspirational statement for conformal field theories. Where moreover, let's assume that the conformal anomaly vanishes, but you know, say I have a conformal field theory where that doesn't vanish, we know how to fix this up and it becomes a modular form rather than a modular function here. But okay, this is some kind of aspirational statement that we like a lot. So let me go back. This is too complicated. First of all, it's in the general situation, some kind of real analytic non-holomorphic modular form. Who knows anything about that? That's way too hard. Let's simplify. And suppose we have at least some amount of supersymmetry, minimal supersymmetry in two dimensions, and I'll insert a negative one to the F, or you can think of it as an odd spin structure, or my fields on the torus here, and I'll get some function that I now call the elliptic genus, which has many nice properties. For one, it's now actually holomorphic, or meromorphic, say. It's a deformation invariant. What does deformation invariant mean? I mean, it's a deformation invariant of my two-dimensional theory. And so all in all, I now get some deformation invariant modular form on H mod SL2Z. And that's just a great invariant that we use all the time whenever we see a two-dimensional theory with some supersymmetry set. So that's a great story. And one thing to say about this is that it's a genus in the sense of Herzebruch. Herzebruch has this theory of invariants of manifolds, in fact, borders and classes of manifolds with some properties. But the important point is just, if you ever see an invariant of a manifold valued in some interesting place satisfying some properties, there's this great theory that is due to Herzberg that somewhat encapsulates this. And certainly the thing that I just wrote down is an example of such a beast, because if I just consider sigma models to manifolds, that gives me some modular form invariant of a manifold. But there's more. I don't need to just plug in sigma models to manifolds. It's a bigger beast than that. It's some generalization of a Herzberg type idea. But okay, given that it's at least a Herzberg type idea, one of the first things that Herzberg might have asked is, how does this invariant behave in families? So if I have some, again, suppose I just have a family of manifolds parameterized by some base space B, and I try taking this invariance, I'm supposed to get some kind of family of modular forms parameterized by some base space B. Okay, so what is that? What should that look like? Well, I don't want to be super precise about this, but basic ideas from supersymmetric quantum mechanics is that whenever we, you know, want to quantize some kind of space and there's some supersymmetry, very often what we get is just the cohomology of that space, in this case with coefficients and modular forms, and maybe that's the answer. Maybe that's what the answer is going to be for what a family of modular forms over some base space B is. And my whole reason for introducing this whole, you know, let's start thinking about this in families and whatever, is, well, originally I had a modular form, that was this elliptic genus. Now I want to say, okay, if I consider this in families, I should get some kind of interesting class in the base space, parameterized by the base space of my family. Maybe I want to call that elliptic cohomology and then play around with these classes. That's a thing that we've seen frequently before in supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And then, great, maybe that's what elliptic cohomology is. Maybe the elliptic cohomology of B just is cohomology of B with coefficients in modular forms. Okay, everybody dislikes that. Nobody's happy with this because it's really boring. I mean, in some sense, it's true. Yeah, great. I define elliptic cohomology to be just ordinary cohomology with coefficients in modular forms, but everybody's very unhappy. So we want some kind of refinement of this. And there's a natural idea, which is that we were trying to parameterize the behavior of the elliptic genus or the elliptic genus in families. Okay. One of the important properties of the elliptic genus was that it was a deformation invariant. Let's just use the deformation classes of the families of the two-dimensional supersymmetric theories themselves. And this idea was really advanced by Siegel in the 80s and then carried forward a great deal by Schultz and Teichner to the extent that it's now pretty much called the Schultz-Teichner program. So that's a great idea. And it certainly seems like it would give some refinement. It's something that maps to this relatively boring and pedestrian definition. It seems like it's something that might have more power in it. Well, okay, so that's one way to get a refinement. There's another obvious idea, which is, you know, just quotient the complex comportism spectrum by the formal group law induced from families of elliptic curves. That was a joke. That was a great joke. I'll pause. You can post your chuckles in the chat to let me know you got it. Yeah, this is not an obvious idea at all. This, if you were just following the story I was just telling, like, oh, we've got an elliptic genus, partition function, we want some refinement. This comes completely out of left field. This is crazy. And the point is that this comes from, unsurprisingly, a very different family of ideas, starting with work of Landweber, Lazarc, and Nolsey Quillen, Novikov, okay, lots of people. And this particular construction, depending on its formulation, was introduced by either Landweber, Ravenel, Stong, or Hopkins, Mahold, Miller. And it's, I don't really want to say too much more about it. The gestation of this idea was from thinking about invariants of spaces, cohomology theories, with well-behaved theories of term classes that add well in a certain sense, and then you just do a ton of algebra and somehow spit out some magical invariants. And there's this conjecture now that these two constructions that I just mentioned agree. And this conjecture is visibly difficult and non-trivial because these ideas come from completely different places. And so it's in some sense unsurprising that this conjecture has been around since essentially the 80s in some form or another. And to some extent, you know, no one's really said, oh, okay, like here's how you start from the datum of one thing and get to the other thing. In some sense, when Davide posed the question yesterday, given a two-dimensional n equals 0 comma 1 theory, how do I start with the physical data, the Hilbert space, the Hamiltonian, I mean, the endpoint code, just whatever data you might want to calculate, how do I get from there to a TMF class? But right now, TMF classes are defined in terms of this stuff right here. So you really need some dictionary of going from the physics to any part of this bag of information, and that's extremely unclear right now. So that's the kind of reason that these things are difficult, and this conjecture has been around for as long as it's been around. The applications of knowing something about this conjecture would be manifold. You might think that's another pun, another joke. It's not. I really mean that this would have a lot of applications. And I think different communities would be interested in this statement for different reasons. I first learned about this idea in the Kant seminar, a topology seminar, where topologists or geometers would be interested in this because if this Siegel-Stoll-Steiner idea were true, we we would have some kind of geometric way to construct these interesting invariants that these folks down here constructed, and then we would be able to mess around with those invariants in interesting ways coming from a geometric origin and maybe be able to prove something about the manifolds, constrain their behavior in some way. This could be of interest purely just in terms of geometry and topology. The physicists might be interested in this for exactly the opposite reason. A priori, we might be interested in these deformation classes of families of 2D theories. Maybe colloquially, they'll call them phases without attributing too much import to that term, but you know, some kind of deformation classes. And this very much harks to the idea of generalized phases, topological phases, that's been in vogue for several years now. I mean, won a Nobel Prize. But to some extent, you can make up these things and you can give condensed matter constructions of them, but it would be really great just to have a formalism which allows you just compute the phases with any amount of flavor symmetry or on-site symmetry or time reversal symmetry or whatever in any dimension. And these are the sorts of techniques that algebraic topologists have really been able to bring to bear. For example, Fried Hopkins, I think in one of the most illustrious examples of this, reduced the classification of invertible phases to some computation in something that I want. There's just a bunch of topological computations you can do now to compute those groups. This would be another example where if you're able to say something about this conjecture, you could compute something about these 2D supersymmetric phases, so to speak, in terms of these topological, elliptic-homological calculations. Which again, that's not easy, but it is something that topologists know how to think about. We have some framework in which to set it up. We have a bunch of spectral sequences we could throw at it. So this conjecture is a great conjecture. Let me talk about another reason that you might care about it. And this is, in fact, just depends on a relatively weak form of the conjecture. So we can talk about, say, topological Buffel-Witten theory, which I'm not sure this is the best name for it. I made up this name, I think. I'm not saying that this is the best name. Someone can tell me a better name. It was explored by these four authors. And the idea here is, again, well, okay, let me say it in words first before going to it. So what's a Buffel-Witten invariant? It's an invariant of four manifolds. There's some physical theory called 40n equals 4 maximally supersymmetric 40 field theory, 40n equals 4 super young Mills. You can evaluate it on four manifolds and get some number. Okay, it's a little bit better than a number. And okay, in fact, let me just say what I have on the slides. This 40n equals 4 theory really comes from the 6D theory, and compactifying that 6D theory on an elliptic curve with parameter tau gives you the 40n equals 4 theory. And if you now compactify that theory on a four manifold, you get this invariant that I call the Buffel-Witten invariant here of your four manifold M that's some kind of modular form tau. One needs to say some words here, like suppose the self-dual second Betti number of M is sufficiently large. Let's not worry about that. I was going to suggest that we turn off the noise entering and leaving. I thought it would, you know, fade away relatively quickly, but maybe that's a thing that one of the hosts could address.
I'll work on it. Yeah,
sure. Thanks. So, okay, that's a fine story. And this is a story that essentially Buffel-Witten told in the 90s, I think, except for maybe this is interpretation of starting from a 60 theory is a slightly more modern point of view. But we could just reverse the order of these compactifications. It helps that the 60 theory is super, so it doesn't matter which one is bigger. But anyway, if you first compactify on the four manifold M, you get some two-dimensional theory, which is still supersymmetric, and the elliptic genus of that theory, just because we compactified on a torus times M in two different ways, the elliptic genus would return this four-manifold invariant that we all know and love, or some of us might know and love, or you can learn to know and love it, it returns this Buffel-Witten invariant. So again, we have this two-dimensional supersymmetric theory whose elliptic genus gives you this invariant. This conjecture that I just mentioned, that I call the Siegel-Stolz-Steiner conjecture now, it predicts a canonical lift of this modular form to a topological modular form. Just because rather than taking the elliptic genus of that theory, you can just take the deformation class of the two-dimensional supersymmetric two-dimensional theory itself. In fact, you don't even need to know that the deformation classes agree with topological modular forms. You just need some map from deformation classes to topological modular forms, which is a much cheaper thing to ask for and in some sense much more likely to be true. I don't want to commit myself to saying the main conjecture is not true. I just don't, I can't comment on that. But I certainly believe that there's at least a map. So we have this And this topological modular form now, you may be called the topological Bafflebit invariant if you wonder. Again, that's a choice in semantics, but it's some canonical lift of the interesting manifold invariant you had before. And you didn't need to do this with the 60n equals 0 comma 2 theory. You could do this with the 0 comma 1 theory, get some kind of Cyber-Britain type thing. There are tons of 61 0 comma 1 theories coming from F theory compactifications and Calabi F3 singularity. So there's just tons of stuff you could do now. You could ask for these topological type lifts of a whole. And again, the formalism is actually ideally suited to saying, well, instead if you have some family of such things, parameterized by some base space, then in fact, you shouldn't just get a topological modular form on the nodes, you should get some class in the elliptic cohomology of that base space B. Maybe that base space has some G symmetry, or maybe even we could just consider the case where the base space, there is no parameter space B, but I just have a G action on the theory, say a G action on my manifold, and I should get some class in some kind of equivariant elliptic cohomology or equivariant modular topological modular forms. So this is an immediate prediction just by thinking about these ideas of Siegel back from the 80s and the many people who marched it forwards. Right, so Andre is asking what structure are these assumed to have? I don't think you need to know much. I would certainly want to know that the ordinary Bafflebitten invariant is a modular form, or you could even beacon that and start thinking about wall crossing and whatnot, but I don't really want to touch that yet. So let's say B2 plus is greater than one, or if you're deep into the theory of Cyber-Quinton invariants, these folks know a lot to say about basic classes and whatnot. I'm not going to touch that. I think aside from that, physically, you have a two-dimensional supersymmetric theory. There you go. I certainly agree with Greg's comment. There's much more to say once you start dropping supersymmetry. But if you start with the 62-0 theory and your manifold is reasonably nice, I think that should give you a topological lift of Bafflebitten modular form. More comments in chat yet? No? Okay. So I just introduced this notion of maybe I have some kind of G action. Maybe I get some class in equivariant elliptic cohomology or equivariant modular forms. In this talk, I'm going to somewhat elide the difference between them, as you may have already noticed if you're an expert, but anyway. So let's talk about adding equivariance a little bit. So let's go back to our previous slides and just throw in some equivariance. So suppose now I have a two-dimensional field theory that's maybe starts out life as a quantum field theory, and then to get to this property down here, I really wanted to be informal with vanishing, all sorts of vanishing anomalies. Let's say I have some flavor symmetry by some group G, some compact group G. Then I could again take the partition function, turning on some background gauge fields, which for mathematicians is just a flat G bundle with flat connection. The G bundle is on the torus on which I'm considering my two-dimensional theory right now. And I need to insert some red text here to tell you what's changed. And here what's changed is that, what's changed is that in the Lagrangian path integral side, I can insert these twisted boundary conditions for my torus. I insert twisted boundary conditions for going around the A cycle. I want to come back to myself twisted by some group element G, and along the B cycle, I want to come back to myself twisted by some group element H. And they need to commute because if I go around the two ways, they better commute. And under the modular transformation property I said before, these group elements get permuted around in some way, they basically just swap. And once again, I could say this is much too hard. Let me try to simplify and get some kind of elliptic genus with these two commuting group elements inserted. So I forgot to mention it before, but this argument that once I simplify in this way, it becomes a deformation invariant of my theory. Now, my theory with G symmetry, it's not meromorphic, it's beautiful. This is a Witten index argument. That's unsurprisingly, you can do Witten, I didn't give it a name. And it becomes some kind of deformation invariant equivariant modular form. Where by equivariant modular form, I literally just mean what I wrote down here. It's some kind of function that transforms in some way. A priori, it's a function on the upper half space H. That's this tau parameter. The C2 parentheses G is just my notation for pairs of commuting elements in my compact group G. And it transforms in some way under the SL2Z transformation. This is a basic example up here. And then, I could also have G acting on my pair of elements by conjugation and should transform in some way. Is that B plus supposed to be B2 plus, probably? So anyway, this space, this H times C2 G mod SL2 Z times G, I'll often just abbreviate by Bungee E. That means something to mathematicians, but it's flat G bundles on the universal elliptic curve. Yeah, that's right. I need G and H to communicate with the supercharged. I need my flavor symmetry to behave well with respect to supercharged. So this Bungee E is something about G bundles on the universal elliptic curve. And that's just notation for the space in which my equivariant modulo forms. But again, let's continue upgrading the slice that I had before. These slightly upgraded elliptic genera are often called twisted twined genera. They're now valued in equivariant modular forms. Again, I asked about behavior in families. I could, again, come up with a kind of silly answer from before. I'll just take some space of equivariant modular forms, consider cohomology with coefficients in that, define that to be G-equivariant elliptic cohomology. Once again, everybody dislikes that. But again, the Siegel-Stoll-Steiger approach would suggest just use deformation classes of theories with G-flavor symmetry. As Greg says, I need to know something about the behavior of the G-flavor symmetry with respect to the supercharge. And once again, there's another idea that comes from the more mathematical side of things, which is even more obvious now. This is crazy. You build some moduli space of derived really spectral algebra geometric objects, some kind of oriented elliptic curves with equivariant structure. This idea was due to Jacob Lurie. And then we just heard a talk by Leonard, carrying this out in some cases and doing cool computations. So, okay, now the conjecture that these two things agree is somehow even more crazy. In this case of equivariant elliptic cohomology, actually, over the complex numbers, there is another cool construction, Nita-Gronowski, where he just somehow directly builds a family of algebras, the commutative differential graded algebras, if you want, over the space that I just told you about, this Bungee E space, that should give you equivariant elliptic cohomology over the complex numbers. And he just writes it down in a 5-page paper, so that's nice. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that as we go through. But once again, you could conjecture that all three of these things agree, and this is even more crazy in some sense. That the two more mathematical approaches agree, this approach pioneered by Lurie and then the Gronowski approach, this is not super surprising. To some extent, this should be taken as a desideratum of any kind of integral model that you build. And we saw that in Leonard's talk just now, where he described how things should somehow live as some sheaf over 1U1E. He didn't call it quite that, but this is not super surprising. In some sense, this should just be taken as a condition that any integral construction should satisfy. But mashing either of these things with the Siegel-Stoll-Steiger story is much crazier. Okay, so let's talk about this conjecture now and what we can actually say about it. So let's just go ahead and say the equivariant conjecture. Here it is, stated somewhat informally, but so phases, by which I mean deformation invariants, exactly in the way that Davide said yesterday, you can go up and down RG flows, you can add and remove degrees of freedom that are kind of not doing anything. Phases of these theories with G flavor symmetry with some specified world sheet torus that I'll call E, and parameterized by some base space M should agree or yield a model for equivariant elliptic cohomology, G equivariant cohomology, as defined in topology, either by the Lurie approach or the Gronowski approach or whatever other more mathematical definition we have. Okay, so this is like way too hard. We're not gonna address this right now. And let's try a much more kind of pedestrian version of it first. This zero categorical and zero chromatic height might mean something to some people. All that I really want to say about it is that I want to start with a much simpler version of it. So here's a milder version of the conjecture. So let's read it first. The algebra of supersymmetric observables of the 2D supersymmetric sigma model to a G manifold N with background gauge fields turned on yields a model for essentially G equivariant elliptic cohomology of M over the complex numbers. There's a little hat on it because I didn't take deformation classes in the right way yet, so it's somehow a little bit more refined. If you're the type of person who knows and cares about this, this is really a differential equivariant elliptic cohomology, and that should be the right extra structure that you're seeing yet before kind of quotienting out those degrees of freedom. And this last thing, this is as defined in Gronowski, and then Dan and I, souped it up a little bit in the paper maybe last year to more conveniently fit with our purposes. So, okay, that's a more modest but still rather non-trivial version of this conjecture, which is really taking something from these physical objects that we're building it out of and mashing it with something that's more directly defined in topology. So can we say anything about that? And this conjecture, we could actually ask for some additional structure. Say, in this theory for Hecobrand elliptic cohomology over on the right-hand side, the way to read this, or at least one way to read this, is that there's this thing in topology that I'm now building out of physical objects. And there are interesting classes in this thing in topology. They're universal Euler classes or Tom classes. They're universal characteristic classes for, say, U of N Hecobrand elliptic cohomology or spin 2N Hecobrand elliptic cohomology. Those classes arise from particular physical constructions now that I have a physical construction for the entire model. And the answer is yes. Okay, so Theo asks, what kind of signal model am I considering right here? I will say, right on the next slide, and we'll talk about it. So just ask me again if you're not happy. Okay, so what was I talking about? Right, sorry. So suppose I want to construct some class in the UN Hecobrand cohomology report. I should come up, in order to do that, I should write down some theory which is parametrized by point mod UN, i.e. some theory with a U of N action, with a U of N flavor symmetry. And all that I'm going to do is I'm going to consider N complex free fermions, supersymmetric fermions with supersymmetric partners just algebraically integrate out. That clearly you can permute those guys. You have the U of N symmetry there. My claim is that that guy gives rise to a particular characteristic class, the universal Euler class in Hecobrand elliptic cohomology in this model here. And in fact, there's a little bit more that you can ask there. Sorry, I meant to say that these Euler classes are particularly important for studying the structure of the push forwards in elliptic cohomology that corresponds to the string orientation of Van de Hopkins Resk that I mentioned a little bit. I didn't mention a little bit. Maybe I'll mention it later. I'm not sure. But this is important topologically for a real reason that I may or may not say more about. And there's even more structure that you could ask for. If I specialize n equals 1 above, then they're natural monoidal structures on both sides. Monoidal is always kind of a pretentious word that mathematicians use. It really just means like you've got an addition law or a multiplication law. So in the case that I've got this theory that I was just talking about in the special case of n equals 1, over on the right-hand side, I'm just talking this characteristic class that I was talking about, this universal Euler class or whatever, that's just the Chern class of alignment. And there's a natural addition structure that you could talk about on that side, which is if I multiply together two line bundles, how do their Chern classes add? I really briefly mentioned this earlier, but you might recognize this as the starting point for the entire topological construction of elliptic cohomology. So that's certainly a thing that we care a huge amount about. On the left-hand side, on the physical side, I've got some kind of monoidal structure, again, just being able to multiply or add things, because I've got U of 1 gauge fields. If I've got some U of 1 gauge fields, I can just multiply those together. That's another natural structure over on this side. And there's a natural guess now for how these two things interact, namely just under this map, which takes this physics object to this topology object, these two things intertwine. That, I think, would be a really strong suggestion of how to start turning some of these physical objects into the objects that are used to build the topological construction of elliptic cohomology. But I'm not going to go into all of that. I'm certainly not going to tell you more about the topological construction of elliptic cohomology. I'm just going to say that this would be a natural structure to ask for and would tell us a lot. And over on the topology side, this is related to the Andel-Hopkins-Strickland construction of, well, okay, never mind. I just wanted to shout out those people. Okay, so we actually have a theorem. We can say something about this slightly modified version of the Siegel-Spolsteiner conjecture. And it looks crazy, and I'll need to walk you through what all of these symbols mean, but hopefully by the time I finish doing that, it might answer, for example, Theo's question. So let's start on the right-hand side. The right-hand side is what I wanted. So I've got G any compact Lie group, M any manifold with the G action. Right now I assume it compact. This is just a technical hypothesis. It could be substantially weakened. Don't worry too much about that. Over on the right-hand side, I've got basically G Hecobrand elliptic cohomology of M, and this should be with complex coefficients. Basically, everything that I tell you is with complex coefficients, and I think I just got bored of writing them at some point. This hat is this extra degrees of freedom that, again, don't worry too much about it on the right now. Over on the left-hand side, this is the real deal. This is exactly what I mean about what I'm saying about the classical algebra or the algebra of supersymmetric observables of the 2D sigma model. Let's just go through it, and then you'll either agree or disagree that this is a reasonable definition. So, first of all, I've got my elliptic curve E, which is some two torus. Okay, we're all happy with that. So far, so good, hopefully. This pi S of E is indicating that I've got some spinner bundle over E. I'm going to take the odd spin structure, but okay, I've got some spinner bundle over E, and I'm going to make it odd in some sense. That's a complicated way to say I've made my elliptic curve supersymmetric in some superspace formalism. This now has two real even dimensions and one real odd dimension. So there's some nice way to do this. Okay, this is now a two bar one dimensional object, because I'm considering a 2D n equals 0, 1 field. I'm now considering maps from that object to this stack over on the right-hand side. This is representing my equivariant sigma model here. This stack is, if I didn't have this nabla here, I'm trying to cover it up with my thumb, but I realize that doesn't do anything, so let's just, nope, that just looks awful. Okay, if I just had the stack M mod G, this is something that, it's the usual orbifold construction in whatever formalism you're happy with. I think everyone is probably happy with this construction in their own language, but for me, I would just say a map from some manifold or supermanifold S in would be a principal G bundle P over my manifold, over my original manifold, and that guy is equipped with a G equivariant map to N. So that's hopefully something that you've seen before in some guys. This nabla just indicates that that principal bundle is equipped with a connection for the principal bundle structures. So this mapping stack or mapping space or however you want to think about it, I really think of as the space of fields of my equivariant sigma model, supersymmetric sigma model. Okay, again, so far so good. I don't know, kind of. Maybe you're losing me a little bit, but hopefully you can at least follow the gist of what I'm saying. The zero now, it's a really important zero, that represents supersymmetric localization. Within this space of all fields, I just want to restrict to the space that's actually cut out by Q equals zero. So now, for example, my fields in my sigma model on the bosonic directions, they're just constant. And now finally, I'm going to say that functions on this supersymmetrically localized space of fields, that's what I'm taking to be the left-hand side, the physical datum of whatever I said before. This script O, it's essentially functions, C infinity functions on this, but together with some analyticity condition that comes from some word identities in the field. So when all said and done, this is the final statement. This is an actual true statement that we prove. More or less, there's actually a little bit more notation as well that I'm not going to say here, but this is close to a precise statement of that, that you know, you can actually. So that's one theorem. I promised you one theorem on the slide. Turns out there's more. Look at that. So this is related to the additional structure I said you could have asked about on the previous slide. The function in the above model that you can now consider on either side, but say on the left-hand side, that's induced by the theory of NVHP fermions, indeed agrees with what we hoped it would agree with, the universal elliptic Euler class. That's some characteristic class statement. But then in particular, if I specialize to the case of U of one, I get some particular function that can be identified with the sigma function, basically some relative of the Jacobi theta function. And you can check very directly that multiplying the U of one gauge fields, the structure that corresponds to with respect to this function, turns out exactly to be the elliptic group law that defines elliptic cohomology. And there are various pretty things to say there about, say, the theorem of the cube on the one hand, and the fact that the formal group law that usually dominates chromatic homotopy theory goes away because we considered some equivariance. I'm not going to stress that in this one. So I recognize that the statements of these theorems are probably difficult to parse. My point is that they give positive answers to the questions that we were just raising. So, okay, that's nice. Right, how might we, I want to give you a little bit of an idea of the proof. And again, I told you that these conjectures are hard and that they stood for some time. And I want to the extent I can, give you an indication of what might be difficult, why people couldn't just write down things like this whenever they wanted. But what's some of the real work that has to go into this? Okay, well, in order to give you any idea of some of the real work that goes into this, I need to tell you what this right-hand side is. This left-hand side is I've essentially defined for you, no matter how abstruse it might be. There's a definition now. This right-hand side, I didn't tell you what it was. And as I told you, we're basically building on this construction of Gronowski, so let me just tell you very schematically what that is. So And suppose that G is a compact Lie group and M is a manifold of G action. I told you that Gronowski, he builds some bundle of algebras or sheaf of algebras or something directly over the space on GE. That space is just parameterized by, again, pairs of commuting group elements up to conjugation. So let's suppose we have a pair of commuting group elements. What's the fiber of this Gronowski construction over this pair of commuting? This pi s, this is taking the spinner bundle over E and making it odd. So I actually said this just to make it more canonical. The usual way that I say this is just, I'm over the complex numbers, just uniformize E, write it as C mod lambda, let's write that as arc. E is the torus. It's a T2, it's an elliptic curve with some specified informal structure, with some specified holomorphic structure. You can also just, So just to finish what I was saying, I think you're good now, but at a more pedestrian level, if E, I'm writing into C mod lambda, R2 mod lambda, I'm just going to upgrade this to R2 bar 1 mod lambda. And I'm going to demand that lambda sits in some nice way with respect to R2 bar 1. There's more to say about it, I'm not going to say. I'm just making my world sheet supersymmetric in some superspace. All right, so I'm going to tell you something about what this Gronowski bundle of algebras actually is. Where again, I'm using that in all of these words in non-technical ways. But at a point G1, G2, all that I'm going to do is I'm just going to take the fixed locus of M with respect to G1, G2, the sub-manifold or sub-whatever I get inside there, which is fixed under the action of both G1 and G2. I'm going to take the cohomology of that guy, made 2 periodic. So I'm just going to join some variables here, beta and beta inverse, where beta has degree 2. Okay, so that's fine. That's a definition that you can make. And I haven't told you anything about how to kind of glue this together for neighboring points, but so far so good, I guess. Let's consider an example. So suppose I have the sphere S2. Suppose U1 acts on it by rotation, my sphere is spinning. So the fixed points are the north and south poles under this rotation action. So then what is the U1 equivariant elliptic cohomology of S2, according to this definition that I just told you? Well, it's supposed to be something over pairs of elements in U1, pairs of commuting elements, but okay, that's automatic. So pairs of elements in U1. And yeah, maybe I should just pause. So everyone, if they haven't already seen this example, has a chance to think about it. Is what, you know, what's the behavior over the pairs of commuting elements at one point versus another point? What are the fibers of this thing that I'm building look like? Okay, it's a rhetorical question. I just want to give you a chance to think about it. But if you have a question, also, you know, please. I see Brian's maybe speaking up, but I'm not sure. So. So, yeah, it's actually a rank 2 vector bundle over this universal parameter space, this pairs of commuting elements, pairs of elements in U1, basically. And that's actually a little bit surprising how that works out. Because let's just consider two cases here. Let's consider, first of all, G1 and G2 both the identity element. Well, then the fixed locus of M under the identity is just the entire sphere, it's the entire S2. And, okay, it's not. Depending on what I do with the degrees, I should maybe say a whole sum of rank 2 vector bundles, but you know, bear with me a little bit here. If I just consider the cohomology of the entire sphere with C coefficients, okay, well, we all know what that is. That's got 2 elements in it, or it's a 2-dimensional vector space in H0 and H2. Fine. Now let's consider G1 and G2, just completely random elements, like irrational rotations or whatever. Then the fixed locus is just going to be the north and south poles. Now the cohomology is, again, a rank 2 vector space, but all living in degree 0. It looks like a very different beast. And somehow these different things are supposed to glue together in some way after I make it 2 periodic. They certainly have no chance before I make it 2 periodic, but after I do, they're supposed to glue together in some way to form up a rank 2 vector bundle. So the entire trick is really this gluing, and it must somehow be very non-trivial, or at least somewhat non-trivial. So if you want to say that anything matches this definition, a good proof strategy is probably first try to understand the local geometry, the supergeometry of this universal parameter space, Bunge E. Then you want to perform a local computation of the physical data of these supersymmetric observables as some kind of drawn cohomology, something that matches this guy up here. And then you need to go through and check that they successfully glue together. And each one of these things is a real thing. Two, in some sense, once you know what you're doing, is sort of formal, but one and three are both actually technical. I don't know whether it'll come off as, you know, smarmy or something if I say this, but it's surprising how much technicality you encounter when you start studying sheaves on stacks on the side of supermanifolds. It gets rough, and you know, really getting in there and understanding the local supergeometry of the stack is, I don't know, it's rough, and that's taken us a lot of time. Neetu has a question. What's the physical meaning of inverting? Huh. I should have a better answer to this than I do. I think Dan would have a really good answer to this. For me, it's usually just something I do, and otherwise nothing works.
It's a section of the Hodge bundle and the dual Hodge bundle, so they're inverses to each other.
Yeah, good. So geometrically, it's certainly my Hodge bundle locally has this section, and again, this construction that I'm giving you, it's all local at first, and then we'll study how it patches up globally. So there's a good reason that it trivializes them that we want to do this. Yeah, okay, I think, yeah, let me leave it at that. A real discussion, I think, would take us to being very careful about degrees in elliptic cohomology and working globally over the stack, and I don't really want to do this right now. It's a good question to which I had wish I had a better answer, especially from the physics side. Okay, so I told you this rather difficult conjecture. I told you a simplification of it. I gave you some things that you can actually prove towards starting to establish some versions of these. And now I want to kind of go on. What happens, you know, after this? So, to some extent, this is actually a question for people that we have a relatively powerful model now in which we can check lots of things. For example, a lot of Davide's conjectures yesterday, I think we can relatively quickly check in our model, and the extent to which you're happy with this depends on the extent to which you're happy with having some kind of complex analytic version rather than an integral lift thereof. And opinions can certainly differ on that, and I'm not trying to, you know, force anyone to a stance either direction. Like I was saying actually before this talk, the claims about, you know, having these Pontryagin duals acting when you take an orbifold sigma, or you take an orbifold of a theory, this is almost immediate, but it's somehow not so different from what would already be in the Orange Book when they talk about orbifolds of 2D CFTs. Something that I think Dan and I talked about is also these modular tensor categories and refining the two equivariants. And I think the modular tensor category formalism is, again, well adapted to kind of building these things automatically. And again, I don't know, your mileage may vary in terms of how much insight you get out of this. So to some extent, I'm asking, like, there are lots of questions you could study now. Which are the most natural ones that would really teach people things? And people should tell me what they think would be most interesting. But first, I want to zoom out a little and go back to saying, well, what is elliptic cohomology specifically from a physics perspective now? And I'm going to list a bunch of things now, kind of going in descending order of structure. So first of all, I think one really strong thing that elliptic cohomology could be is an actual two-category of boundary conditions from some TFT point of view or whatever, but it won't be a TFT, but okay, of some three-dimensional sigma model with target n. I think this would certainly be more structured than any of the things I've talked about before, an actual two-category that's stronger than any kind of integral lift of a complex vector space or anything like that. But I should say that a priori, I only expect this to be a very well-behaved object if I have a lot of supersymmetry. And in that case, my category of boundary conditions would probably be something more like a holomorphic or algebraic version of elliptic cohomology that should map down to anything else. And I'll double back later to say why I'm only really comfortable making this assertion if I have that amount of supersymmetry. I would like to weaken it. Maybe I can. I'm not sure. If you have ideas, you should tell me. Okay, another thing that we talked about and that we've already introduced are these phases of deformation classes of supersymmetric 2D theories parameterized by some base space. And here are a couple other things. So what I just told you about was really an integral thing. It should be some abelian group, probably. Okay, that's hopefully finite rank over Z. Once I go to the complex numbers, there are a couple more points of view as well. I think this should also be the Hilbert space, some supersymmetric Hilbert space of a 3D sigma model to M, the Hilbert space on a torus A, or what I most directly talked about here so far, some algebra of supersymmetric observables for the two-dimensional sigma model with torus worldsheet and some target N. And there are ways to go back and forth between all of these. To some extent, you can basically only go downwards. Going up is kind of adding more structure. You can't usually go up. One thing that you might really think about and care about is in these latter two cases where I only have the complex vector space, what additional structure does it take beyond what I've written here to get back to more of an integral structure? And usually the kind of story that I have in mind here is that local operators are parameterized by some Hilbert space, some complex vector space. But if I look at extended operators, those often give me more integral structure. So you could ask in this case about the behavior of extended observables, which is, you know, unsurprisingly related to what I listed at the top of the slide. And this is all, in some sense, a big brother of a story that, to some extent, has occurred before. Either there are snatches in the literature or people just said it. This is all, in some sense, a big brother of a story for K-theory. And now everything, I think, is on certainly a better footing, where we understand much more of it. This two category of boundary conditions of a 3D sigma model becomes more like, well, you could just consider a one category of boundary conditions for a... That's too long. I'll read it later, but I like it. Keep asking questions. You could ask about one category of boundary conditions for a 2D sigma model with some amount of supersymmetry. Here, the cleanest thing that I know is assuming you have, say, 2,2 or 0,2. Well, let's say 2,2 supersymmetries, and I could take the B twist, get the B model. Everybody knows, if you know the story, then you know that automatically gives you some kind of category, which decategorifies to algebraic K-theory, or holomorphic K-theory. Yeah, I agree with that as well. Some kind of boundary conditions for the B model. This thing up here would just turn into phases of some kind of super quantum mechanics parameterized by some base space. This thing down here, you could just ask about the Hilbert space of the same 2D sigma model or some algebra of observables for super quantum mechanics. In some sense, everything is on a much happier footing there. And yet there's still a sense in which I'm not happy with this, because I just said that K-theory, the one category of boundary conditions, if I have enough supersymmetry, it's really some kind of algebraic or holomorphic K-theory. The topological K-theory itself, the more naive thing, that also comes from a category. The usual way that we see it defined is as a decategorification of the category of vector bundles. Or even if you start thinking more fancily about Fredholm operators, yeah, there are categories to put into play there as well. And I would really like to understand that as well as some kind of one category of boundary conditions of a less supersymmetric model. So going up one dimension, I do wonder if elliptic cohomology does want to be more too categorical. And that would certainly fit well with a lot of the two equivariance type structure that you see as well. So I don't know. So far, all that I've really been able to prove a theorem about is just this fourth thing right here. And I've motivated it by relating it to the second thing. I have nothing more to say about the others, but I would like to. This is actually kind of a weird thing that I just said. I just said that the two-dimensional sigma model, it really has Hilbert space, the complexified K-theory of M, rather than the complexified cohomology of M. Why am I saying that? These things are the same. There's a churn character from the K-theory to the cohomology, which after you complexify is an isomorphism. So why am I making this big song and dance about saying that there's a difference here? There are a couple ways to see that they're different. One is if M is not a manifold, but actually a stack. And this was first noticed in the context of discrete torsion. Then this K-theory, as opposed to the cohomology, actually picks up some other contributions from twisted sectors, which are, again, perfectly analogous to the kinds of G and Hs that I had before, one dimension down. And I do wonder if there's another story with functoriality as well, which is related to the questions I was asking the other day in his talk, where the push-forwards in K-theory are different from the push-forwards in cohomology, precisely by some Riemann-Roch type square, some AHAD genus or Todd genus, depending on what you're doing. And I do wonder if physically it's more natural to see one rather than the other. But anyway. Oh, great. Greg has already told me yes. So I'm very happy with this. This is beautiful. You know what I would like even more than this? The story of One Dimension Off. How's that? Maybe we'll just make this a question and answer between me and the chat. And the chat is going to be Greg Moore, and we'll see how far we get. Yeah. Tell me about this One Dimension Off, because I would really love that. Anyway, so this was my attempt to zoom out and just say, here's a bunch of structure that I expect, and what are things that we could, you know, concretely study now? So what do we attack next? Okay, most obviously, Dan and I addressed something about the Siegel-Stoll-Steiner conjecture in a very reasonable setting that already told us a bunch of structure, like the group law coming from multiplication of U1 gauge fields, but we didn't see much of the integral left or categorical left, if you think that should exist. So there is some extent to which we can go further. We believe we have a model for this thing that we call KMF, or G-equivariant KMF. What is KMF? It's kind of cobbled together notation for something built out of TMF over the complex numbers and Tate K theory. Very aphoristically, I suppose, if you think about TMF as being something about modular forms, the Tate K theory is just something about the Q expansion thereof. So what's going on here is that I'm saying a priori I know something about modular forms over the complex numbers. Let me assume that beyond that, I know that the Q expansion of this modular forms over the complex numbers is integral in some sense, sort of has integral coefficients, something like that. Then if that space of modular forms with integral Q expansion, that's something like KMF. That was a real down and dirty way to describe it. It's clearly not that easy, or we wouldn't, you know, have a story to tell you, but in some sense, that's the story that you might have in mind. And we have a physical model for this guy as well, because we know how to build G-equivariant Tate K theory in a nice way with a map down to this thing, some kind of churn character map down to our Durand model. And I want to, yes, thank you. Yes, there's a lot that people know in the non-equivariant case. I was just about to cite Kieran Luck. I always forget how to pronounce that. I'm sorry, someone should, I guess you can't chat to me and tell me how to pronounce it. That wouldn't work. But yes, Kieran worked out a nice model for this guy in terms of G-equivariant Fock modules, which is exactly the same idea that we have in mind. The only thing that, yeah, the claim now is that there's a nice churn character down to our Durand model that we talked about before. And yes, Gerd Loris worked out a lot of the story for the, or all the story, really, for the non-equivariant. I also want to mention that once you start getting to some of these more refined versions, this still isn't TMF on the nose. It's some kind of, you know, weird beast that sits in the middle, where it's kind of building up by stages. But you can already see a lot of the interesting, even for G trivial, G a point. Even for G a point, you can already start seeing the interesting torsion classes and that come from some kind of secondary invariance type instructions. I want to shout out Gunke and Naumann here, that I think morally is similar, even though technically it seems completely different. And maybe Theo can tell me what the relation is that he thinks to the instructions of torsion classes from physical models that Davide talked about yesterday in his joint work with Theo and Ed and some part. Yeah, Theo asks a question in the chat that I don't have a good answer to either. I can let someone else feel that maybe. It's a reasonable question. But it's a good thesis and I like it. And I should have more to say immediately about that. Right, okay, so anyway, this is a whole story about, this is the most natural thing to do based on the motivation that I provided you so far. This is a kind of stranger question that you could ask, but what happens when you replace the torus with a higher genus surface? Okay, everybody's unhappy now because I didn't assume any kind of conformal invariance a priori. In fact, the models that I know best, again, are single models to manifolds, which unless my, well, okay, usually not a conformal invariant. So you need to either say, well, I only care about the constant curvature slice of genus G surfaces and then do something strange or, you know, do something. But it is, at least mathematically, a tempting question to ask. And what happens to the entire story? Like, okay, like all of these things. Certainly, if I have some two category whose chiral homology or factorization homology or whatever should return some of these other things, well, I could take that homology not on a torus, but on some higher genus surface. I could take the BPS Hilbert space on some other, well, on some other surface. Okay, there are issues with that, so I don't expect it to be super nice, but it's a question you could ask, and the reason that I could really care about it is that Alvarez and Singer do have some proposal for what they think these sort of twisted partition functions are, but they have to rig it up in a very nice special way to get a good formula. But there is a thing, and I think we can build an analogous Durand model over the complex numbers, some kind of genus G cohomology that, again, is very poorly behaved from a lot of points of view, but it doesn't have a formal group law that exists over the integers, for example. Or if it does, it's in some way that's completely mysterious to me. So there are lots of things that don't work out from all points of view in the story, but there's some things that do. And I would like to know more about this. I see I have a particularly cryptic comment here that M2 brains can end on M5 brains. Okay, what is that? Okay. This is a question that I have, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's already been discussed in the literature. It might even have been discussed already sufficiently to say that this is crazy. But usually, TMF most naturally comes up if I want to embed it in string theory and the heterotic string, because it comes up when I have chiral supersymmetry on the world sheet. And you know, those original papers that Witten wrote in the 80s was because he was interested in the world sheet of the heterotic string. But there's another point of view where I kind of really want TMF to figure in M theory in some way. So M theory, for those not already initiated in this, is some kind of lift of the type 2A string, where I add an extra circle on top of that whose radius parameterizes the type 2A string coupling. And the type 2 strings kind of are well known to relate to K theory in some sense. And a story that I've been trying to tell you and haven't emphasized as much in this talk as in other talks I've given is that TMF is one circle up of K theory, and K theory itself is kind of one circle up of ordinary cohomology. So there's some kind of impetus to say that TMF should figure in some way into M theory. So, you know, how does K theory play a role in the type 2 strings? Well, certainly one thing you can say is that the D-brain charge lattice in type 2 string theory is most naturally K theory, or type 1 is some kind of real K theory. One way to see this sort of from the point of view that I've been talking about now, or just to fit it into the point of view, is that the D-brains, the first way we usually learn about them is that they represent places for the fundamental string to end in some kind of supersymmetric way. Well, this fundamental string, that is exactly the kind of supersymmetric world sheet I was just talking about. It ends, and I've got a boundary condition for the supersymmetric world sheet. That's exactly the type of thing that I said represented K-theory a couple slides ago. So, okay, great. So let's consider one of these configurations, say a fundamental string ending on a D-brain, and just lift it to M-theory. Here are some precise words if you want. I could come up with an M2 brain in M theory ending on an M5 brain. And now this M5 brain represents some kind of supersymmetric boundary condition for some kind of roughly a 3D signal model. Okay, again, it's not that, I know it's not UV complete, but it feels like there's some sense in which you want the charge lattice of M5 brains to most naturally be topological modular forms now. Is there anything you could say with respect to this? Well, so there's this interesting paper of Friedmoor-Siegel, and you know, all of these ideas, to the extent that they're real ideas and not just my, you know, awful readings of them, I learned from papers of Friedmoor, Witten, Alvarez Gomez, all the, you know, grand guard of the string theorists in those days. It suggests that, okay, if you really want this to be true, then this theory, this cohomology theory, should have some kind of self-duality. In some sense, it's just taking its coefficients, there should be some kind of reflection where the coefficients in very positive degrees reflect the coefficients for very negative degrees. And this is a thing that we can see in our model. In fact, you can see it even before this model. Some version of TMF is indeed self-dual with shift 21. This is due to Vesna Stoyanovska. And she did a much better thing than I'm saying right now. She didn't just do it overseas. She like actually did it. And but at the level that I'm talking about here, you can directly see this kind of self-duality with a shift, because it comes down to serre duality on the modular curve on H-mod SL2Z. And all that you need to know is that the canonical bundle is isomorphic to some power of the Hodge bundle. It's somehow one forms are related to modular forms of weight minus 10. The modular form weight gets doubled when I talk about this degree in TMF. So it's kind of, I've got a shift of 20. And then just the fact that I'm taking an extra cohomological degree to turn on serre duality in the first place turns a shift to 21. Okay, anyway. I've got this kind of self-duality which seems to match in some natural way. Does that have anything to do with this? Right now, I can't, you know, build an explicit, I don't even know an explicit theorem to try to prove, but these are the sorts of things that I find tantalizing and that I would like you know, any of this, let me go back to maybe this slide. Any of these things, I would like there to be natural questions to try to show now from this point of view. What Dan and I have a model, we're working on making it stronger. What are good things to try to show about? So that's my talk. Thank you for listening, and then I'll take any further questions. Thank you.
Are there questions for Arnav?
Can you, your very last slide, Arnav, mentioned, like you were talking about capital TMF all the time, and then the very last line is about mixed TMF. Do you have any physical insight for what kind of capital T lower MF is?
Not beyond the obvious. Capital T lower MF is related to extending your theory, not just for smooth world sheet toroid, but to the nodal one as well. Okay, should you be allowed to do that? Maybe sometimes. So far, I've treated this more as a game of do my Q expansions, can I pretend that they have, that they start with Q positive as opposed to Q negative?
Right. Does your DRAM model, can you adapt it to the mixed capitalization case?
I wouldn't say I can do this in a natural geometric way where I explicitly write something as direct as this thing here, and I change my E to a nodal curve, and I build a whole family of these guys. This is not a thing that I've done. This is not a thing that I've even tried to do, mostly because, honestly, Dan and I got kind of scared of all the technicalities of super stacks. They're really awful, and I don't want to start working with mapping stacks of super singular. Okay, you know, awful. Probably, I wouldn't be surprised if there is some such thing to say. I personally think it's going to be kind of horrendous to actually try to prove. But just at the level of a DRAM model, I think, although this is not one of the most recent things we talked about, I think we can build a DRAM model which extends to capital T lower MF and by just patching it together, essentially because we understand take K theory very well. And you know, if I want to build something over M11 bar, it suffices to understand it over M11 and then the formal disk and then glue it over the punctured formal disk. So kind of just directly, I think we can build that model as a a fortiori after this thing that I pointed out here. Maybe that answers your question. So Leonard has a question that I don't have a good answer to either. So first of all, one thing that I think you can tell is that I'm not very happy with this top thing that I said, because so far I only really expect it to work if I have just a ton of supersymmetry. If I have a sigma model, this basically means that my target sigma model is hyperkähler. It's, you know, it's really special. And then in that case, I think there is a story that works and works nicely, that there is a two category of boundary conditions there that I'm not going to remember all the names to say here. Brzezinski, Witten are certainly some of the first names to say, because analogously to this B model that I mentioned, that twist of the 2D 2.2 sigma model up in 3D n equals 4, that's probably the twist that I want to consider. To study the category of boundary conditions of that 3D theory, this is certainly very related to work of Oblomkov and Brzezinski, but also a lot of other people related to kind of sheaves of categories over some base space. I don't remember who all is responsible for this. I think Toan and maybe one of his students. I certainly talked about this with Nadler. I know he was interested as well. Yeah, Kapustin and Salina in the physics literature did this. Actually, I think they may have also talked about the two category boundary conditions. Yeah. So there's something there, and I expect that to have charge lattice elliptic cohomology or some kind of algebraic or holomorphic elliptic cohomology, analogously to how the B model had some kind of charge lattice algebraic K3. Alexei, I bandied about some ideas about how to see the DRAM model that I have with Dan from that point of view, and it seemed to fit well, but I don't have more to say about that now. I would like to either reduce the amount of supersymmetry that's required, I don't know if that's possible, or I would need to know more about the integral structure on my side to start seeing cool things. It's really frustrating to me that I don't know, I personally don't know, and maybe Greg Moore will tell me right now in the chat, which again would be fantastic. what the interpretation of the categorification of topological K-theory is. There's some kind of equivalence class of a category whose decategorification is K-theory. It seems like a natural idea would be to consider like some kind of n equals 1 comma 1 sigma model and ask for supersymmetric boundary conditions there. And this has been studied by Albertson, Lindstrom, and Zabzin, but I didn't find that the kinds of boundary conditions they found really mesh with topological K-theory. It seems something more like real Bordism mixed with K-theory in some sense. So, okay, I don't know. But it's frustrating to me that there's a natural category sitting around for K-theory, and I don't know what it is.
Any more questions for Arnav? All right, let's thank him again.